Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight to the Sydney Institute, where Helen O'Neill makes her inaugural appearance. She's well known these days as a writer, but I'll introduce her briefly. Educated at the University of Western England, came to Australia, or started off as a journalist in Britain, and then in Australia for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Australian, and editor at Vogue Australia. Since then, she's been a freelance writer, an author, and has done documentaries. But as an author, she's an award-winning, internationally published journalist and author of Life Without Limits, the David Peskund story, the critically acclaimed Florence Broadhurst, Her Secret and Extraordinary Lives, and David Jones's 175 Years. And Helen O'Neill is here today on the occasion shortly after the publication of A Singular Vision, Harry Seidler. And I think the topic we have today is Harry Seidler's Sydney. Helen O'Neill, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Hello, everybody, and thank you so much for coming. Thank you also, Gerard and Anne, for inviting me along to talk. You unwittingly gave me a slight promotion. I was never the editor of Vogue Australia.
Well, you should have been.
But I'll take it and run anyway. Thank you. Now, the title of my talk is indeed Harry Seidler's Sydney Vision. Harry Seidler being the subject of my latest biography, and Sydney, of course, the city he made his home. Now, I first arrived in Sydney fresh from England in the late 1980s. I took a job as a young journalist at the Sydney Morning Herald newspaper, and at that time found myself also having to take something of a crash course in my new culture, in its hierarchies, which are different to the British hierarchies, I think, in the personalities, the politics, the assumptions, the controversies. This is where I first heard the name Harry Seidler. And I remember being somewhat surprised by the emotions he appeared to provoke. From some quarters, there seemed to be almost a river of venom travelling towards this man. And at the time, back then, I couldn't quite understand it, because he was a creative, an architect of all things. What was going on? Around 4 years ago, I was approached by Penelope Seidler, who is the architect's widow. She wanted to ask me if I would be interested in working on a biography about her late husband. I agreed, and the result is this book, Harry Seidler, A Singular Vision. It's a biography that is authorised, but is absolutely not sanitised. The Seidler family at no point had control over the contents of the book. Indeed, I wouldn't have entered such an arrangement on a project like this. And I have to say, after all these years of working on it, what a project it's turned out to be. This man's story, this architect's story, raises issues of perspective, issues of debate, issues about what progress could and should entail. It's a story of cultural cage-rattling, of control, at times of what it means to be an outsider. Such ideas and other ideas are fueled by the concrete objects, by Harry Seidler's legacies, and some of these are easy to see. They're the buildings he created in Sydney, in particular, but across Australia, in Europe, and in other parts of the world. There is also the artwork that is in place, that is an integral part of these buildings. And then there is the more nebulous question of the influence that he wielded, and what this has, or should have, resulted in. Someone said to me the other day, Harry Seidler is an interesting character. People tend to either love him or hate him. And what I found is that it's not quite as simple as this. For example, I realized fairly early on as I researched that some of the heavyweights of international architecture wanted some form of involvement with this book. Oscar Niemeyer, who is a very recognizable name, one of the most significant architectural figures of the 20th century, wanted to contribute. I.M. Pei, who is probably best known for his glass pyramid outside Paris's Louvre Museum, he wanted to talk to me about Harry Seidler, his friend, a man he described as one of the world's great architects. Lord Richard Rogers, another big modernist name, a British architect, he echoed that sentiment. He told me there are not many like him. Upon Seidler's death in 2006, the architect Glenn Murcutt described the difference between Harry's ruthless public persona and the person that he knew as a fellow architect and a friend. He told the ABC, Harry was a roaring bear, but I can tell you he was also the most cuddlesome person you could find. Harry had a gentleness, a kindness. This is a great loss to Australia to have lost Harry. And yet, during the process of writing this book, I also encountered, particularly in Sydney, utter disdain. One person I mentioned the book to fairly on in the piece said to me, Helen, I don't understand why you'd want to take this on. Why on earth would you want to write a book about the man who ruined Sydney? The answer to this question, and to many of the others, I think, lies in just who Harry Seidler was. His life story begins in Vienna, on the 25th of June 1923, when he was born to a reasonably affluent family. His mother is called Rose, his older brother, Marcel, and his father, Max, jointly runs the family textile business. The Seidlers are Jewish. My book is a heavily illustrated work, and one of the earlier photographic images shows young Harry in Vienna at the age of 13 with the first real love of his life, and it's a bicycle. He looks so happy in this picture. It's actually one of my favourites from the entire book. You can see he hasn't got a care in the world. It's shot in Vienna. The year is 1937, and he doesn't know it, but everything is about to change. The following year brought the Anschluss. Adolf Hitler invaded Austria. And in January of this year, 1938, young Harry had started a diary. It would be the first of a series of diaries that he kept. And from these diaries, both as a boy and as a man, you can see that he had the instincts of a historian. From it, we get a bird's eye view from this first diary of an extraordinary moment in time, as seen through a very particular prism. The prism of an unusually intelligent, if actually rather lazy, schoolboy. Read the book for the full picture, but in short, what happened was that Harry and his family had to leave. The efforts of his older brother Marcel, who already happened to be in England, were critical at this time. And the Seidler story encompasses a variety of other stories. Marcel's is one of the most poignant, I think, and one of the most interesting. Marcel manages to get Harry to England, and he finds him a home with an aristocratic pair of elderly sisters who live in Cambridge. Harry has absolutely at this point fallen on his feet. He's in an intellectual environment. He learns English very fast. He begins studying building at Cambridge Technical College. His parents do manage to escape as well. Later, Harry Seidler would suggest that he felt they should have left much earlier. They had their reasons for staying, but they did manage to escape. The Seidlers lost many, many family members who did not. So in England, the Seidlers are together, nominally. They aren't living together, but at least they are safe. Or are they? In 1940, at the age of 16, Harry and his older brother were interned by the British as enemy aliens. Winston Churchill would later call his refugee internment policy a deplorable mistake. But that admission came years too late for the tens of thousands of people, many of them Jewish, that he locked up. And Harry Seidler was one of the youngest. Again, he kept diaries. And these are searing accounts of what he saw, what he experienced, and what he would later identify as a sense of pure injustice, a scream of pure injustice. He would be incarcerated for a year, over a year and a half, almost 2 years, firstly in England, then in Canada. He saw things that today beg a belief, and this would have a profound and enduring impact on him. When the Australian government started indefinitely locking up child refugees, Harry Seidler spoke out against this policy. He said he found it painfully similar to what he'd lived through. He described it as a grave act of inhumanity, as torture, and he said politicians ought to be put in jail themselves who allow that. He and his older brother Marcel found themselves incarcerated with many other people. But, and here is the one of the great dichotomies of the Harry Seidler story, they were locked up with intellectuals as well, with lecturers, with specialists in a variety of different fields, including art and architecture. And it was here that Harry began to learn. It's possible that this single-minded focus of learning about architecture insulated him to an extent from what was taking place around him. Certainly, he dived into these studies, and it changed his life, in a literal sense. On the 4th of October, 1941, Harry was released. He called it the greatest day of my life, and he'd been released because he'd used his studies to, in a sense, force his release. He had won a place to study architecture at the University of Manitoba. This university had allowed him in. He'd used his passion, his need to escape detention. But it was a bittersweet moment. While he walked out, his brother Marcel had yet to be released. At Manitoba University, Seidler learnt, in a formal sense, about architecture. He learnt about modern architecture, and he became entranced. He would go on to seek out Walter Gropius, the founder of the Bauhaus, a man who himself had had to escape Nazism and who by the 1940s was running the Graduate School of Architecture at Harvard, not an easy place to get into. Harry Seidler managed it. Now, Seidler considered Gropius a visionary. Modern architecture at this time was actually about more than rebuilding after the war, although there was for sure a lot of rebuilding to be done, particularly in Europe. To Harry Seidler, it was a philosophy, it was a methodology, and he would become evangelical about it. He studied also under Joseph Albers, the artist, who was another Bauhaus master at Black Mountain College, and he began working, once he'd done this, for a man called Marcel Breuer, another Bauhaus name, and his architectural practice in New York. But Harry's parents, by now, were settled in Sydney, and they desperately wanted the family to reunite, as did Harry, which is clear from his letters of the time. But he also wanted to be at what he saw as the centre of his true world, the architectural world. And this was not Australia. This was where he was living, in the States. So his family hit upon the perfect lure. They would give this young, eager, hungry architect carte blanche in his first real commission that would be to build his parents, Max and Rose, a home, a family home. He agreed to visit Sydney to do this, but made sure, interestingly, that he spent 3 months with the modern architect Oscar Niemeyer in South America on his way across, and he soaked that in too. In September 1948, he arrived in Sydney, and judging from most of his reactions, he was not terribly impressed. He built that first commission, which we now know as Rose Sidler House, in the Upper North Shore suburb in Sydney of Wirunga, where it remains to this day, in tip-top condition largely. It's an interesting object. It's elevated. There's floor-to-ceiling glass. It plays with the space. It talks to its surroundings in a way that we understand quite clearly now, but that back then these things weren't so clearly understood. It was a fierce piece of modern architecture at that time. Now, Harry had not walked into a vacuum here. There were other good modern architects at work, but no one, from what I could see, who had quite his attitude, his ferociousness, his level of creative ruthlessness, and his determination. He hit Sydney like an asteroid, and those ripples, I think, can still be felt to some extent today. Before he knew it, he had a raft of commissions for other houses, and this is the primary thing that kept him here. He began fighting early on, fighting with local councils to get his visions realised. He would never ever stop fighting, because for Harry Sidler, architecture was deeply personal. And he nailed his colours to that mast very early on. Rose Sidler House, for those who've seen it, you'll know, it has a mural. Now, for this architect, art and architecture would always be profoundly linked. And he would, over the course of his life, his working life, generate a significant bounty of commissioned architecture, often paid for by other people and galleried out to the public. Indeed, you can do a tour around Sydney of art that would not be here had Harry Sidler not determined that it should. Within a few years of arriving in the city also, he had begun commissioning Max Dupain, the photographer, another modernist master, to record, to photograph his work. This would mark the start of a very close collaboration which would go on for well over four decades and which would come, in some senses, to define both of these men. Through these pictures, and in the early days, of course, these are primarily pictures of Sydney buildings, you get a literal sense of Sidler's vision. Now, one of the great joys of book research is unexpected spin-offs, and whilst I was researching this book, Penelope Sidler, at her home in Kalara, handed me a box, which is just something she'd kept aside for decades, which turned out to be full of a unique series of beautifully developed Max Dupain images, black and white. They are stunning. They're really stunning. And they're photographs of Paris. Not something that very many people have seen from this photographer, and certainly something that would not exist had it not been for Harry Sidler. The story behind these images, behind what it took to get Max Dupain, who hated travelling, out of this country and into Paris, is a very revealing one about both men. I tell it in the book, and it'll be told again soon, because these images are to become part of a special exhibition being held at the Art Gallery of New South Wales from May until September, which is lovely. But coming back to Sidler's Sydney vision, there is another angle. Early on in his life, this polarizing man, who was never afraid to speak out, started making public comments about the need for real urban planning, about the dangers of unfettered urban sprawl, about how properly to control development in order to create communities, neighborhoods, cities that he felt would work. In my book, I detail an instance in the mid-90s where Harry Sidler publicly pitted his vision for the city of Sydney against the vision of Frank Sartle, who was then mayor. Sidler never stopped trying to explain how he saw things and why. This was a passion of his, was attempting to communicate these views. And in this encounter, which is actually televised, the single-minded passion that he has for his home city is evident, as is his frustration with those who don't see things the way he sees things so clearly. Speaking of passion, another pivotal moment for Sidler was meeting a woman called Penelope Evatt. who was the daughter of the barrister and Labour politician Clive Evatt, and the woman Harry Sidler would in 1958 marry. This pairing would prove enormously influential. She told me that when they first met, it took her a moment to realise what it was she was meeting, but at one of those very early dinners, he actually told her, in all seriousness, that I am going to build cities. It was a huge worldview. In the 50s, Sidler also started a professional partnership with a man called Dick Dusseldorf, another very interesting individual who would begin the company Lendlease. And while working with Dusseldorf on Sydney's landmark Australia Square project, and this is a project that in completion would become the largest lightweight concrete structure of its kind in the world, so we're talking about a very pioneering form of building here, Sidler made sure that he was collaborating with the world's best engineer, a man called Pierluigi Nervi, someone who Sidler felt was an artist because of the way he could express himself in concrete. Since then, Sidler's Office of Architects has produced something in the region of around 180 different building designs, but his reach actually goes far beyond his own work. He was a fighter. He fought for things he believed in, and he fought against what he saw as injustice. One surprise for me was the extent and the closeness to which Sidler's relationship with the Sydney Opera House sits. Now, this building would have to be one of the most significant in this country, certainly one of the most internationally recognisable. And Sidler fought for it right from the word go. He fought for Jørnutsen, he fought for the design, he fought for creative integrity. It's an interesting story. And it goes back to a point that I wasn't quite expecting, to be honest. In 1957, you may recall, some of you who were here at the time, the Opera House competition. And there's a story, a great story from this, where the one judge, Eero Saarinen, arrived late from overseas as a judge, picked up where everyone else had left off, decided he would go through the discarded competition entries and found, amidst the ones that the other judges had decided not to go with, an extraordinary entry by Jørnutsen. He convinced the other judges, and, you know, a long story, but here we are today. But why was Saarinen here? Well, he was here because he was a great judge to pick. But I must say, looking back at some of the links, the suggestion for Saarinen, the pressure to get Saarinen over, has the smell of Harry Sidler about it. Certainly if Saarinen hadn't been a judge, we most likely would not have this opera house. People have asked me if there are any questions I would want to ask Harry Sidler. And one question I would dearly have loved to ask the man is the absolute ins and outs of how Saarinen arrived, if this was down to Harry Sidler. Saarinen visited Rose Sidler House while he was here, and when Utzon was declared the winner, Harry Sidler was interviewed, the firebrand architect who had also put in for this competition and who had lost. He'd been beaten too. He immediately called the design magnificent. He applauded the judges for having such courage, and he then wrote a letter which ran in the Sydney Morning Herald about this, which began with the words, "Architecture is a language, and architects speak it. Most of them barely manage to speak. Very few ever speak eloquent prose, but it happens rarely indeed that any of them create poetry with just a few words." Sidler had an instinctive, clear vision. He knew what he was looking at when he looked at those beautiful, impossible opera house sketches. And he knew what he was looking at when he looked at Sydney. He had a vision, I think, that extended much further than most people know. On top of this, there is a question of character with this man. I, as a journalist, was a journalist in Sydney who did not happen to interview Harry Sidler during his lifetime. And I wonder, in part, if that was to my advantage. I know journalists who were, one might say, monstered by Seidler. He had an interesting relationship with the press. As a biographer, I think it's important to come to a project without, certainly without an axe to grind, and if possible, without any baggage. Having not met Seidler, I think to an extent this was an advantage for me. Harry Seidler, his story, is such an interesting life story. It's large in every sense. The world events it encompasses are large, traumatic, things that absolutely set the tone for much of what was to come, not just in Europe, but worldwide. The buildings are large, some of them too large for some people. The personalities involved, again, these are big, important personalities. The debates which were sparked, the emotions which were provoked, and to an extent which remain provoked amongst some people. The legacies which remain. Where the Harry Seidler story begins is a world away from where it ends in Sydney. There are times where, working in non-fiction, I have to say it outstrips what fiction can produce. Certain life stories are epic, and this, I think, is one of those. This tale of one man, one singular vision, one city, and that city was Sydney. Harry Seidler.
So many thanks to Helen O'Neill for the paper, and Janet Grundy's got some copies of A Singular Vision. Harry Seidler's got some wonderful photographs in it, as well as some fine writing. So there you go. So we come to question and discussion. We have plenty of time. Remember not to stand in front of the camera. I'll just lead off. I didn't meet Seidler, but I saw a lot of him on television. He seemed to me to be a man who was often aggrieved. For example, you mentioned his internment. I mean, as you know, he wasn't interned because he was Jewish. He was interned because he was Austrian. And the British authorities at the time didn't trust Germans and Austrians for good reason. They made mistakes. I mean, a friend of mine who was interned, he understood this and said, well, better to be interned by the British than to be killed by the Nazis, was Hugo Wolfson's position, who we knew well. But Seidler seems constantly aggrieved. He does seem a very arrogant person, and he does seem to be a person who is highly critical of others, but extraordinarily sensitive to criticism of himself. Just tell us a bit about his personality as you read it.
There seems to be, I mean, these are all good points. The business of internment's an interesting one too, because in fact what the British government at that time was doing was interning everyone with a German passport, and of course there was no such thing at that point as an Austrian passport, so Harry Seidler had to leave on a German passport with a J stamped in it for Juden. And the rights and wrongs of this, you know, can be debated. But I would say I have spoken to many people who feel that the internment situation for Seidler, it was a crucible for him, not just in terms of learning, but also in terms of focus and approach to life. He does appear to have come across as arrogant quite often. It's interesting. And there are a number of things. He also had a flash temper. The sense of him being aggrieved, again, is an interesting observation. I think often, from what I can see, he was certainly frustrated that people simply weren't seeing things the way he thought they should see them. This was something that was ongoing during his life. In terms of PR, I would say at times he could have done better. That's for sure. There were decisions he made sometimes that had I been there to counsel him, I would have said, maybe don't go there. But at the same time, the more I researched, the more I realised that there was a big difference between the public and the private persona. With the private persona, you're dealing with a very different sort of man, quite a gentle kind of man, as Glenn Murcott said to me. One of his family members told me one of the key things about Harry Seidler that you had to understand was that there were only two spheres in life for him. One was architecture, and the other was family. And to him, the architects he worked with were also family. And I had an interesting experience when I was discussing Harry with a man who'd known him very, very well for a long time. And we came to the subject of Harry's death, and this man burst into tears and just started telling me how much he loved him. Not something you might expect from a ferocious, aggrieved, arrogant man. Other stories that started coming out were stories where Harry had actively attempted to help people get into the profession, stay in the country, these kinds of things. Things that he didn't publicise. He didn't feel the need, but that he felt he should and must do. So, complex man.
Right, so... Oh, down the back. Yeah, that's it.
When you speak of Mr. Seidler's vision for Sydney, mm-hmm. do you actually have documentation that's available of his drawings that you draw and the architectural plans of the overall vision?
The question about Harry Seidler's overall vision for Sydney.
There are, held in the Mitchell Library, an awful lot of Seidler's plans and drawings and blueprints and so forth. There's a lot of information about the plans Seidler proposed for certain areas of Sydney within this. The television documentary I told you about, I'm not sure if that's available online, but transcripts may be. But certainly, if you're looking for these sorts of things, the first place I would say to go is the Mitchell Library.
Right down the back here. Yeah. The question is, when he arrived here, he wasn't happy with Sydney, as you mentioned. Why do you think he changed his mind and decided to stay?
You're quite right. When he arrived, he was here to do one job, and that was the job for his parents, Rose Seidler House, as it became called. He very quickly found himself with just a wealth of other commissions, other houses, for all manner of people. Some were part of the Jewish diaspora here, others different, all manner of different people. It was interesting. And you have to remember, as he himself once said, he'd come from New York. He'd been working with Marcel Breuer, who was quite a name. And Breuer, at times, was having trouble getting commissions up. He walks into Sydney, and there is such a hunger for what he's producing that he has, you know, commission after commission after commission. So it actually didn't make any sense at all to leave. I think as this rolled on and he became, you know, more au fait with Sydney and started making different kinds of connections, after this the relationship with Dick Dusseldorf became a key one for him, because Dusseldorf was doing what Harry wanted to do, which was building big. So we have Blues Point Tower, Australia Square, these sorts of projects. And I think for an architect, if you're getting these sorts of opportunities, if you're forcing these sorts of opportunities, it doesn't really make any sense to leave.
The criticism of... I'm not an architect, eh? But the criticism, I think, of some of these buildings, like Australia Square, is that when you walk past them, there's sort of nothing much there except concrete, and they go above you. In other words, I think that one of the criticisms of Seidler was that there was no great streetscape where he was, that he didn't really believe in that. I mean, how do you regard his architecture? I mean, you've mentioned, I mean, there's some other big buildings that he did, aren't there?
There's a lot in Sydney.
Well, just name some of them for us.
MLC in Tower in Martin Place is another big one. I would say with regards to streetscaping, this is something that Seidler actually paid a lot of attention to. And one of the breakthrough things about Australia Square was the nature of the streetscaping. So he provided places to eat and drink that were covered. He made sure that there was put in place here artwork that everyone could see. The biggest sculpture is, of course, that Alexander Calder sculpture, Cross Blades, that is still there. He elevated these large buildings so that you could have artwork galleried out within them. And again, with Australia Square, if you look at that, this is still here. Now we're quite used to these ideas. They're much more, you know, they're much more normal to us. But back then, they weren't. And in order to make this happen, Seidler had to be extremely determined, and he'd found the right backer too. Düsseldorf handed over. He had a lot of confidence in his architect, Düsseldorf, and Düsseldorf financially, you know, ensured this would take place in as much as he could. So I would say the one thing Seidler was always passionate about was providing streetscape, providing things that were usable within a city. He felt Sydney was a city where you could build high, and actually you should build high, but that that shouldn't happen at the expense of people being able to move around, walk around, enjoy it at the street level.
Okay, there's a question here, then we go over here, yes.
We know Harry Seidler, he's a big name in Sydney, whatever. How does he fit across Australia, across the world? Where does the Seidler name fit there? How big is he? Mm. And will he be remembered, and will his buildings last?
I feel sure he will be remembered, yes. And the buildings, they do last. It's interesting, one of the earlier houses, something called the Igloo House, which I think is in Mossman, might be wrong about that, but it overlooks the water. It's for sale at the moment, and there's an interesting, you can look it up online, there's an interesting little video relating to it. Harry Seidler remains noteworthy because of reasons why the Igloo House stays in its form, because he pushed engineering and technology and building and construction and design in this country. He really pushed it, and at times was doing things absolutely for the first time, as with Australia Square. He's, in terms of how he's considered, I think there are still some people who are rather bruised by his personality, perhaps. There is an awful lot of respect from the architectural community as well that I've encountered. In terms of being a world player, that's really interesting, because I think this is still being sifted through. And it may well take some time. I wonder if he provoked such strong reaction, such strong emotion often. And sometimes when this takes place, the dust settles more slowly. And I suspect that may be happening with Harry Seidler. He saw himself as an international player, always. And hence he had these relationships, these friendships with the other big international players. How he will be judged alongside these people in, say, 10 or 20 years' time, or 30 or 40, I couldn't say. It'll be interesting.
Question over there. Yeah.
Yes, I was wondering more specifically about the you know, there's the Blues Point Tower, and there's a big apartment block also in Tamarama, and another one in Four Clues, the big concrete blocks. I was just wondering, you know, what he was trying to achieve when he... Because, you know, aesthetically there's some beautiful buildings. I actually believe Myra Street as well, but those blocks are much less aesthetic.
There's three different projects you've talked about, and one thing I discovered really, really fast was in architecture, when it comes to a building, every building has a story. And some of these stories are little and funny, and other stories are epic, and the Australia Square story is almost Shakespearean in its, you know, scope. Blues Point Tower is an object that is a result in part of its time. Of course, he was working with certain kinds of restrictions, and the design you see is as a result of keeping within those restrictions. But also, interestingly, he would later say that he was inspired by an artwork created by one of his mentors, Joseph Albers. And in the book, what I do is present Australia Square and also present this artwork, so you can see, if nothing else, what Seidler's talking about, and work out for yourself whether or not you think this works. The other two projects I probably shouldn't comment on, because I think at least one of them is not considered a Seidler project, actually, at all, certainly by Seidler and Associates, from what I gather. I may be wrong about this. And, which was in Vaucluse?
There's a big similar,
quite
square
block. Yeah.
Once again, right on the edge of the cliff. Mm. But it's just a square block.
Yeah. It's also interesting to see the progression of Seidler's work. So one thing that started to happen was you would get many more curves in the work itself, that it would start to become more organic in feel than these big blocks. I can't comment particularly on that one, but again, I would say behind every building lies a story. They're not always easy or simple stories. And one of the things that this project did for me was made me... I have a real respect for architects who managed to get their vision realised as opposed to an amended version of that vision.
He did say the Blues Point Tower was his finest building, didn't he?
He often defended it. Yeah, he did. he also, I think, had a bit of a sense of humour. I wouldn't... but... I would say also that he never, ever criticised that building. He wouldn't do it. He had reasons for making it the way he made it, and he stood by those through thick and thin.
We've got a lot of hands up. Everyone just be relaxed. We've got plenty of time. There's a question here. We go down the back. Come over here. Yep.
I have two questions.
Oh, well, brief.
The first is it possible to identify any building or buildings which are regarded by his peers as his most significant works? And my second question is, has he done any work overseas?
Certainly Australia Square is considered a landmark building for a whole series of reasons.
Right.
And a whole series of reasons. And if you actually go in and you look at things like the ribbed ceilings of that building, yeah, you can see an artistry to the detailing that is a result of him having made sure that the engineer he was working with was brought in to work on that building. Different buildings are considered significant for different reasons. What was the second part?
Overseas.
Buildings. Yeah, he did a number of buildings overseas. In Paris, what Max Dupain was photographing was the Australian Embassy. So this is a work of his, a very significant commission. One of the ones that was closest to his heart was a very large project in Vienna, which he regarded as coming home, in a sense. He was given a gold medal by the Viennese government. He was given an honour. And sure enough, eventually managed to take control of a rather large housing complex, which is there. I went to visit it quite recently. It was interesting because having spent so much time in Sydney and gotten used to... This is really Seidler City. You get used to walking around and seeing the curves and seeing what you just sort of understand automatically are parts of the thumbprint of Seidler here. It was actually rather strange being so far away and seeing buildings from a distance and then walking through them where you're having the same feeling. It felt like bits of Sydney, but it's not. So there's that one. He also worked in Hong Kong and I believe in Acapulco.
Right down the back.
Obviously, Seidler has people pro and against. It sounds as if the architects are pro, and it's the non-architects, I'm just saying, who are more critical of the building because some of them, like Blues Point Towers, are very brutal. And I'm not an architect. We don't know the whole room and all the planning. I think a lot of buildings were planned there. It was very cost-effective. Is that the public who are more critical of his work than the architects?
The suggestion is it the public, the non-architects who are the big critics rather than the architects?
That's a really interesting question. The answer would be that it's not as simple as that. I think within the world of architecture there are a range of tastes and a range of views. I've noticed within architects there is often a great admiration for Seidler for being so single-minded, regardless of what that person's taste might be. But it's a range of views that I've encountered amidst the general public as well. One of the most common questions I've had since I've written this book is, what do you think of Blues Point Tower? And usually what that question is all about is what the person who's asking me thinks of Blues Point Tower. And so I found myself at some do, and a gentleman came up to me and said, and what do you think of Blues Point Tower? And I said, what do you think of Blues Point Tower? And he said, well, I I look at it every day because I end up walking my route to work takes me where I see it every day. And do you know what I really can't understand about Blues Point Tower? And I said, no. And he said, I can't understand for the life of me why they didn't make it higher.
There's a question here, yes.
Just the book about Sydney Opera House has a lot of these quotes in that book.
In my book?
No, in the book,
The History of the Opera House has got some quotes about Seidel on these matters. So there's a question down there.
Yes, yeah.
There's a question down there.
My original question was going to be the comment about the settlement on the coast of the banks of the Danube River, that large complex that you built with kindergartens and libraries, and it's a very compatible piece of architecture. But surely the criteria for a lot of the people in this debate should be how happy are the people who are the occupants and the residents and the dwellers of these buildings and who the users of these buildings, how compatible and how agreeable do they find it to be?
Okay, so the question is, what about the users of these buildings? Do they find them agreeable or not?
It probably depends on the user and depends on the building in general, I would say. Hard question to answer, but your point about the Viennese complex is absolutely right. It was a complete complex. So there are kindergartens, there are...
There's one on the Danube.
This is the one on, New Danube City. It's a complete complex. And one thing Harry Seidler was always quite passionate about was that buildings should be planned and that there should be everything in as much as there can be there. So this was part of his sort of rationale. I don't think I'm answering your question very clearly, but,
There's a question here.
Have you seen Seidler's Opera House design? Is it any good?
I have seen it. And if you want to have a look at it, I'm pretty sure that's in the Mitchell Library as well, in their database online. Is it any good? It certainly is quite Seidler-esque for that time. And he, having seen the winning, what he considered was, having seen the winning design, had no compunction about what should have won. So.
There's a question here.
Yes, you were talking about Adam Niemeyer, with whom Seidler came in contact when he was in America. And I imagine that he quite admired his work. But did he ever express any opinion about our own capital architect, Burley Griffin? Did he have any relationship to him? Because Burley Griffin, in his own way, was a pioneer.
He was, yeah, and not always understood, I think. Seidler would have considered himself a pioneer and also considered himself at times not understood. He did speak on this, but I can't. I can't tell you right now. But he did have views about Canberra. He did end up building in Canberra as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So when you said earlier that some people think he destroyed Sydney, what do they mean by that?
Yeah, I think probably they're largely talking about the controversy around Blues Point Tower. Would be my guess. And Blues Point Tower is an interesting building because it became something of a lightning rod for all sorts of arguments and all sorts of emotions. And I think into this feeds worries about how things are developed, how decisions are made, public involvement, these sorts of things. It's not all about Seidler here. There was one key thing that happened was taking the architect, taking the cartoonist Patrick Cook to court. You have to wonder, I wondered if Harry Seidler had not opted to do this, whether or not it might have diffused to an extent some people's recollection of that time and some people's view of this building.
Right down the back and then up here.
What was his entry to the Opera House condition
like? I should have brought her. No. I recall it's quite rectangular. Yeah. And it actually followed the brief, which I understand that the winning design didn't necessarily do, which was interesting. But I recommend you have a look. You can check it out online via the Mitchell Library's website. I'm pretty sure of that. And there's also, you can have a look in the book.
Right, a question here.
One of the legacies that often comes from famous people like Snyder with architecture is that it produces students who go on, obviously, proselytised in the same way. Mm. Would you say that there is a school, a Snyder school now, which can be traced to him through the teaching and other things, if he did teach?
And that is a good question too. There doesn't appear to be, in essence, a school of Snyder. What there is the Harry Snyder and Associates business still works to this day. And there are in here architects who have worked with Snyder for a long time and many other architects who've sort of come in and out of this business. No school of Snyder as such.
Question, Robert.
He seemed to have a knack of obtaining front row sites. But on the other hand, you look at some of his sites and although they weren't exactly front row, like perhaps Grosvenor Place, he managed to turn it into a front row site. Do you have an opinion on that? And did he have some particular associations with people that he had helped him secure the sites that he might be interested in?
The relationship with Dick Dusseldorp was a critical one. He understood the importance of a site and, as you say, was able to work when you didn't necessarily have the obvious view or the obvious incline to create one. It's a combination of factors, is probably the simplest thing to say. Don't forget, with Rose Sidler House, he was working with a site that most people might have actually ignored, and certainly with his family home in Kalara, you look at the site there and it would have been treacherous to work with. It would have given, I'd imagine, the builders absolute palpitations because it's just, you know, it's a precipice. It dives, it's difficult, there's cliff edges. He played with these things. One of the things he was able to do was take a site that was awkward, really physically awkward and so scary that some people might have backed off at those times and turn it into not just usable but something really quite special. Up in the... There's a house called the Berman House, which is one of his last significant houses. And here, it's up in the New South Wales highlands, and there's a track you take to it, and it feels like the track's quite scary. I did it a while ago. And then this house is perched on the edge of a cliff. And not only this, what Harry Snyder has done is he's created a gangplank. It feels like it's a walkway. So he's brought you to the edge of the cliff. And then he's created something that's made of, it feels like glass, whereby you can walk straight over that cliff.
I think we're about to finish, but... Yeah, well, I'll just ask one, then you ask the final question. He did something, I don't know how you get to do this, but he ended up with an absolutely adoring wife. I mean... So tell us a bit about... So tell us a bit about... I'm sorry, I had no idea. Okay, we'll come back. Tell us a bit about Penelope Sidler. I mean, she is... I mean, there may not be a Sidler legacy, but there's certainly a Sidler fan club. So tell us a bit about Penelope.
Mm. Penelope is a very, very interesting woman. Harry's meeting with Penelope was such an important one, and it seems as though he knew pretty much straight away that this was the woman he wanted to spend the rest of his life with, be with, have the family with. She's a very intelligent woman. She's a determined woman. At the time when they met, she was doing a degree in one thing, and they came back from their honeymoon, and she switched over into architecture, which I think was 5 years at that time, in order to understand her husband and his vision more fully. And then she went on and qualified in another business area as well, and she has since run the office. But she's also been... the relationship between Penelope and Harry is a really interesting one, and I do look at this in the book. There are times when I feel that she sort of smoothed things over when Harry, who had such a fierce haste, troubled waters. There are, she has a different kind of view of art than Harry Seidler did. His vision was pencil beam thin, and Penelope's was much broader. And I think we're seeing now, perhaps since Seidler's death, more of this as she, you know, is becoming more of a better known as a patron of the arts and so forth. But one thing she said to me was that the only thing they ever really truly argued about was art. And this would happen when she would find herself buying things she liked and bringing them home and perhaps even hiding them from her husband. So infuriated at times would he become with this betrayal of his vision.
Final question.
I wanted to extend the wife question to the Evatt connection and how much that was important to his ability to have connections. I mean, their family are very well connected. It might have also helped Penelope understand irascible personalities because she had an irascible father.
father.
But the thing was that did the Evatt connection help him settle into Australia when he married Penelope?
So this connection was Bert Evatt and Clive Evatt, Penelope's father, and Bert Evatt, Penelope's uncle.
There was an encounter that Seidler had with Clive Evatt before when Penelope was still a child, in fact. Seidler was very good at working out who the main players were and getting to know them and attempting to influence them and so forth, particularly in those early years. But I saw nothing to suggest that there was any form of direct assistance in terms of leg up or anything. Yeah. Well, more subtly, I'm sure it didn't hurt being part of the Evatt family, but at the same time, Harry Seidler was very much his own person, I don't think he actually would have needed any form of real leg up. I think determination. He was, I know, very pleased to meet Penelope's sister Elizabeth because she had also been to Harvard, and these connections were also important to Harry Seidler. These sort of intellectual connections.
Many thanks, Ellen. Just sorry for a second. We're right on time. So many thanks to Helen O'Neill for a fine presentation. Now, this is a terrific book, Singular Vision, Harry Seidler. Anne and I are in the unfashionable club. We quite like Blues Point Tower, so there you go. Without question, Harry Seidler was one of the most important Australians of his generation, without question. And you've done a remarkable job in recording his history and the history of Sydney in particular, but Australia in general, surrounding the Seidler contribution to Australian society after he came out here after the Second World War. So, well done. I'm sure you're working on some other project that you probably won't tell us about, but when it comes out, you must come back. But tonight, well done and thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.